Soren.
Great, great.
Scoping out the 10 Soren wormhole. Take it away, Peter.
Okay. Okay, so I'm holding here the 10th Torrent N300S that I purchased from 10th Torrent's online store. And if you like what you hear in this talk and in the next talk, you can go to their store and buy your own wormhole card. There are a bunch of other form factors in that store as well, but this is not a sales talk, it's a FOSDEM talk. We're here to talk about open source software. So, point one, 10th Torrent make an open source software stack for that hardware, and all of that hardware is up on GitHub, you can go and find it, it's all great. But I don't want to talk about software, I want to talk about hardware. Because I believe that good software developers need to really understand the hardware on which they are running. So I'm going to tell you all about the hardware here, and then you can either think about what the software should be, or better understand why the current software is the way it is. Now, I don't want to take my card apart, because I paid good money for it, but if you did take off the case and the heatsink in the fan, you would see this photo here. But I'm not going to talk about PCBs, because I don't do PCBs, so we're going to switch to this much simpler block diagram here. So on the bottom we've got a PCI Express thingy, on the left we've got two QSFP cages, and then two proprietary Ethernet ports on the top, and then in the middle of the card we've got these two wormhole chips, each flanked by a bunch of DRAM. Now if I shuffle things around just a little bit, I can show you how everything is wired together. There we go, so I've drawn three types of connection here. Each green line is representing DRAM, the red line is representing PCI Express, and each blue line is representing bidirectional 100 gigabit Ethernet. Now, in theory, each wormhole chip can drive 16 ports of that 100 gigabit Ethernet, but the form factor of this particular board only gives you 8 ports of Ethernet on the left chip and 4 ports of Ethernet on the right chip, which is, you know, good, but it could be better. But in any event, the scale-out here is Ethernet. You know, at some point, your AI models are going to get larger and larger, and they're going to get too large for a single chip. Even if your single chip is like the size of a whole wafer, Cerebras, you will still need multiple chips at some point. So the hope is that you can buy as many chips as you need, and then link them together with point-to-point Ethernet in whatever topology makes sense for you. Is that what I wanted to say here? I think so. Yep. Okay, so, however, if you scale out too much, then giving each chip its own PCI Express connection is going to get a little bit pricey. So the hope is that we can get away with giving only some chips a PCI Express connection and relying on Ethernet to reach the other chips. And this board is designed to give you a little taste of that. So as you can see, the chip on the left here has a PCI Express connection, but the chip on the right does not. So it is only reachable via that Ethernet link printed onto the circuit board here. So from a software point of view, this means that you can mmap memory from the left chip, you can't mmap memory from the right chip. Implications for software there, I'm just going to leave that sentence there and move swiftly on. So if we zoom in to one of these chips here, we see a 10 by 12 grid of tiles. We've got various types of interface tile around the edge. We've got Ethernet tiles left and right, DRAM tiles top and bottom, and then also on the bottom, one PCI Express tile and one ARC tile. Now, on the form factor of this particular board, two columns of compute tile, which is all this stuff in the middle, are disabled for yield reasons. So I'm just going to mark two columns here. I've kind of randomly chosen two columns, but it will vary from chip to chip just based on the yield of where the defects are on these tiles. If you buy other form factors, you can get more compute tiles. If you buy an M150S board, which I think someone has at the back here, you get 72 tiles. And if you buy a Galaxy system, you get all 80 compute tiles on every chip. They've saved the really good yielding chips for that particular product, which will cost you lots of money, because you know people have to make some money. Okay, so what's next? So I've numbered each DRAM chip, each DRAM tile based on the DRAM module that it connects to. I've numbered each Ethernet tile individually because point-to-point Ethernet links are unique. I've not numbered any of the other tiles because all the compute tiles are identical to each other. Now, before we delve into the various types of tile here, I'd like to talk about the memory hierarchy. More to the point, the lack of a memory hierarchy. So on most GPUs, if you get one Today, you'll have a single address space that spans the entire kind of chip, kind of covering everything from the compute to the memory, and you'll have various layers of caches in between the compute and the memory. But we have none of that here. There are no hierarchy of memory, no caches. And instead, each tile has its own address space. And if you're running code on one of these tiles, then you can only access the memory of the local tile. So your load and store instructions can only access the local tile. But of course, we need some way to move things around further than just a single tile. Otherwise, life would be incredibly boring. So that's where the network on chip comes in. Now, before I can add that network to this diagram, I need to make some space. So I'm going to get rid of the external things here and shuffles around from the physical grid to the logical grid. So all the same tiles, but we're just now viewing them in a slightly changed way. And now I can add the network on chip or NOC to the diagram here. So this is all of these purple arrows. And this links every tile to every other tile in a 2D torus. So if you go off the right edge, you end up on the left edge. If you go off the top edge, you end up on the bottom edge here. And each NOC transaction, so any tile can initiate a NOC transaction, and each transaction is effectively an asynchronous memcopy. Now, I've put the conceptual API for this on the slide here. You choose two tiles by giving the x and y coordinates in the tile grid, and you copy some bytes from the address space of one tile to the address space of the other. And in most cases, the tile that is that is causing this transaction to happen will be either the source or the DST, but you can do more exotic things if you so wish. Now, I should also mention that each NOC transaction has some overhead to it. So for kind of peak performance, the transfer size, the number of bytes here, wants to be in the range of like 1 to 8 kilobytes. Which if we're used to the NVIDIA world, it's going to sound like quite a lot. So kind of quick change over to the CUDA world. In that world, you're kind of thinking like 128 bytes as a kind of like transfer size. Because you know, in that world, you have 32 threads in a warp, and each thread issues a 4-byte load, and the hardware will coalesce all of that into units of 128 bytes. But switching back to this tip here, we have none of that. We have no coalescing of memory. You know, you have one thread, and you issue a single large 1D memcopy, which is a little bit limiting, but hopefully not too so. I guess also limiting is that we can only move rightwards and upwards on this particular network. But for that problem, we have a very simple solution, which is there is a second network on chip that is identical in every way, except all of the arrows go in the other direction. So this guy can go, you know, left and down, and again, it's a 2D torus. If you go off the far left, you end up on the far right. If you go off the far bottom, you end up on the far top. And both of these networks, in addition to doing plane copies, can do multicast, and they can do atomics. And all three of these things, plane copies, multicast, and atomics, are naturally asynchronous. So you fire them off, and then if you care about whether they complete, then you can poll to ask whether they have yet completed. And this is the second major difference to the usual GPU model, in that if you need to hide any latency, i.e. of memory, then you are using asynchronous APIs to do that. There is no automatic context switching between multiple warps. So again, another major thing to bear in mind there. So you're going to want to hear about these various types of tile. And obviously the compute ones are where the magic really happens. But we're going to keep you waiting just a little bit and look at every other type of tile first. So looking at the arc tile first, this guy is boring, but it has to be there to do, you know, power, thermal, clock, and reset management, you know, things that have to happen somewhere, but you don't really have to care about what they really are. So code for this particular tile is currently closed source, but it's not really a problem because you can basically forget about this tile is even there, other than if you need to reset the board or change the clock speed. So we can move swiftly on to a more interesting type of tile. So DRAM tiles. Each DRAM tile is a bridge between the network on chip, drawn here in purple and in teal, and a DRAM module, each DRAM module having 2 gigs of DDR6. And these tiles cannot initiate NOC transactions of their own, but you can read or write from them from other tiles using a NOC read or write. And if you do that, then the address space of these tiles is extremely simple. The first 1 gig is the first 1 gig channel, the second 1 gig is the second 1 gig channel, and the rest of the address space here is unmapped. So these guys are where you're storing all of your large matrices. If we move on again, we reach the PCIe tile. So this guy is a bridge between the network on chip, again in purple and in teal, and the host address space. So if the host system issues a read or write against the board, this tile will translate that PCI Express read or write into a NOC read or write against the address space of some other tile. And we've got a 496 megabyte aperture for that purpose, broken up into a number of regions, and each region can be mapped to some per tile address space, depending on kind of where you want to map them to. Going the other way, if some other tile issues a read or write against this tile using the NOC, this tile will translate it to a PCI Express read or write against pinned physical host memory. And if you're using 1 gig huge pages, you can pin four of them to get a 4 gigabyte aperture going in that direction. Moving on again, we finally reach something particularly interesting. So this is an Ethernet tile. And at the top there, we have a programmable RISC-V core, which is what makes this guy interesting. So this is the RV32IM instruction set. So we've got some integer GPRs there, 32 bits wide, and a 32-bit program counter. And it can do all the usual RISC-V things. We've got an integer ALU there. We can do control flow with branching and calling. And we've got a little load store unit. And then a number of things on the memory bus which can be accessed by that load store unit. So we've got a block of SRAM there in pink that holds all the code and data for this RISC-V core. And then on the left of SRAM, we have two NOC interface units, or NIUs. And these are how the RISC-V talks to the NOC. So these guys can either initiate NOC transactions of their own, or they can service transactions which have been initiated by other tiles. So if you are running code on this RISC-V and you want to initiate a NOC transaction, then you take the arguments for the asynchronous memcopy, you put them into some memory mapped registers on this load store unit, and then you write a go signal again with a memory mapped register. And if you care whether the thing has completed yet, again, you can read from a memory mapped register to find out whether things have finished. So if you are used to doing any kind of low-level kind of like driver dev, then this pattern should be familiar to you. And if not, you can wrap it up in a nice API to hide all of the finicky little details. Now, on the other side of SRAM, we have two other units. We have the Ethernet transmit unit and the Ethernet receive unit. And this pair of units is, again, an asynchronous memcopy thing. So it can do an asynchronous memcopy, albeit only from the Ethernet tile that is the source here to some other Ethernet tile. So, data can flow from the SRAM in this tile through the Ethernet transmit unit over a point-to-point Ethernet link to some other Ethernet tile through that tile's RX unit and into that other tile's RAM. And the sender will specify the destination address to write to, hence why we've not had to put the receive unit on the memory bus here. I should also say that if the Ethernet link flaps, then the RISC-V is responsible for noticing this and retraining the Ethernet link. And again, there's a tiny little bit of a closed source firmware for doing that retraining should you need to, which is unfortunate, but it is what it is. So moving on again, we reach what we are actually kind of properly interested in. So this is a compute tile. Somewhat similar to what we just saw, all but with five RISC-V cores up there rather than just one. Again, it's RV32IM instruction set on each and one bare metal thread running on each. So again, it is one thread per RISC-V core, and if you want to hide any latency, then you are using asynchronous APIs to do so. There is no automatic context switching between multiple threads. So again, on the left of SRAM, we have two NIUs, just as previously, and then a huge block of RAM here. We've got more RAM here than on the previous tiles, so the Ethernet tiles had 256K of RAM on them. These guys have a meg and a half. But it serves the same role. It holds all of the code and the data for these five RISC-V cores. And then the majority of the tile on the right is taken up by this 10.6 coprocessor, which is where the magic really happens. Now, I've drawn it on the general memory bus here, but in practice, only the three RISC-Vs on the right can meaningfully talk to it, which leads to a very natural division of labor, where the three RISC-Vs on the right drive the coprocessor, leaving the two RISC-Vs on the left to drive the two NIUs. And then they can all kind of communicate to SRAM to share things. So obviously, we need to zoom into this guy, because this is where the magic really happens. And there we go. So I've drawn kind of front-end type bits in green, back-end type bits in brown, memories in pink, and instruction arrows in lilac, if the lilac has come out on the slides here. So at the top here, we've got three instruction FIFOs, FIFO being another word for queue, if that's not a term that's familiar to you. And there's no kind of real like control flow in the front-end here. If there is any control flow, which there will be, then the RISC-V cores, which are now kind of zoomed out, they will resolve all of the control flow that you have, and then each RISC-V will push a stream of 10.6 instructions into one of these FIFOs. And we've got three FIFOs here, hence why only three RISC-Vs can meaningfully talk to this thing. So there are two ways to push instructions into these FIFOs. The first one you'll probably guess, based on the theme of what I've been saying, is that you can do memory mapped writes to some memory mapped register to write into these FIFOs. You're going to be pushing a lot of 10.6 instructions into this guy to do the real work. So there's a second, cheaper way to push things in, which requires a quick diversion into RISC-V. So if you are familiar with RISC-V, you should know that 3/4 of the opcode space is reserved for the RVC extension. But none of these calls implement the RVC extension, which leaves that 3/4 of the opcode space available for other use. So it gets repurposed. And if any of these RISC-V calls are given an instruction in the RVC opcode space, they will not treat it as a RVC instruction. They will instead treat it as an opaque 32-bit value to push onto the FIFO attached to that call. So whichever way we've pushed things into these FIFOs, if we then look down, we get to the next unit, which are these macro expanders, which are configurable units that allow one instruction to expand out to several. And if you configure and use these guys properly, then you can keep the back end of the 10.6 unit fully kind of saturated, only needing to issue kind of one instruction every kind of 10 cycles or so from the RISC-V, because you can expand out 1 to 10 on average, which frees up the RISC-V to do other things, such as resolving all of the control flow. Stepping down again, the next unit here is the synchronization unit, and it contains, it gets three streams of instructions flowing in from the top, and it then muxes them out to the various backend units underneath. And it contains some mutexes and semaphores to control the relative ordering of things between these three streams, which you're going to want to use because the various backend units here are shared between the three incoming streams, both their execution units and the registers in all of them, which is a little punchy.
Getting real quick.
Okay, fine. I will therefore give you very briefly on all of the units here. We've got unpack on the left to move stuff from SRAM into the unit. We've got matmuls on the middle unit there. That's where the matmuls really happen. FP8 at full rate or BF16 at half rate. Well, BF16-ish at half rate. It's a little weird. FP16-ish at quarter rate. And then you can push your data back out from your pack unit back out to SRAM after you've finished working with it. And then all of the config on the side, you can either drive from memory mapped writes for the RISC-Vs or from the scale unit on the side there, which is there to help you drive all of this config. I'm told I'm out of time, so that'll have to do there. And you can then zoom out, and we are back to where we started with this nice photo. Thank you.
Give him a round of applause. And just like the previous speakers, I'm going to kick Peter out over there so you can go find him if you have some more questions about his presentation. Martin, there you are, buddy.